From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Saddam Hussein's trial is a milestone in the Iraqi people's efforts to replace the rule of a tyrant with the rule of law. It's a major achievement for Iraq's young democracy and its constitutional government.
Saddam Hussein is sentenced to death. Legal experts question the trial and legitimacy of the court itself. Others are asking about the timing of the verdict 2 days before the midterm elections. And we'll talk about the elections with New York Times editorial writer Adam Cohen.
Voters around the country will be going to the polls tomorrow, and there will likely be a lot of problems. 80% of the people will be voting on electronic voting machines, which have a lot of problems already. We've seen them in early voting. We're also likely to see problems with voter ID and even voter suppression.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Iraqi court has sentenced Saddam Hussein to death by hanging for committing crimes against humanity. The decision was announced Sunday, just 2 days before the U.S. midterm elections. As Chief Judge Abdul Rahman announced the ruling, the former Iraqi president cut him off and declared, "Long live Iraq."
The court has decided to sentence Saddam Hussein al-Majid to be hanged until he is dead for crimes against humanity.
Long live the people, long live the nation, down with the agents.
Two other senior aides, including Saddam Hussein's half-brother Barzan al-Tikriti, were also sentenced to death. His former vice president was sentenced to life, and three minor Ba'ath Party officials received long prison sentences. The five-judge court found Saddam Hussein guilty of executing 148 Shiite men and boys from the town of Dujail in 1982. The killings occurred a year before Donald Rumsfeld shook hands with Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. To prevent an outbreak of violence, Baghdad and four provinces have been under a curfew for the past 2 days. Amnesty International criticized the court proceedings, saying they failed to meet the standards of a fair trial. One Saddam Hussein's attorney, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, described the proceedings as a mockery of justice. Clark was thrown out of the court Sunday for handing a note to the judge criticizing the trial. Meanwhile, the European Union's urging Iraq not to carry out the death sentence. The EU opposes capital punishment in all cases. President Bush praised the court's decision.
Saddam Hussein's trial is a milestone in the Iraqi people's efforts to replace the rule of a tyrant with the rule of law. It's a major achievement for Iraq's young democracy and its constitutional government.
Leading Democrats questioned whether the court's decision would make a difference on the ground in Iraq. This is Rahm Emanuel, chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign.
You know, at that time when he was caught, the president said, "We had turned the corner in Iraq." And after 3 years, 3.5 years, $380 billion, nearly 3,000 American lives, that was a slogan then, like mission accomplished, and we haven't really accomplished much in Iraq.
Rahm Emanuel was speaking on Meet the Press on NBC Sunday. In Mexico, hundreds of thousands of protesters marched in the city of Oaxaca Sunday, calling for the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz and for federal police to leave Oaxaca. Supporters came from throughout Mexico, including a caravan of over 100 cars, trucks, and buses from Mexico City. The protest came 8 days after Mexican President Vicente Fox sent thousands of federal police officers into the city to crush the popular uprising in Oaxaca. But the police have been unable to take control of more than the city square. Meanwhile, on Sunday morning, gunmen opened fire on a student protester outside the university radio station. The 22-year-old Marcos Sanchez Martinez was reported to be in critical condition. In other news from Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador has announced the formation of his resistance cabinet. The former presidential candidate said the cabinet would serve as a counterweight to President-elect Felipe Calderón, who will be inaugurated on December 1st. Calderón is scheduled to meet with President Bush at the White House Thursday. Andrés Manuel López Obrador also voiced his support for the protesters in Oaxaca.
Para exigir el cese a la represión y el retiro de la Policía Federal Preventiva de Oaxaca.
I reiterate, the federal police need to desist from their repression and leave Oaxaca. The solution to this conflict must also include new elections.
A 16-year-old Palestinian boy has died in the latest Israeli airstrike in the Gaza Strip. Over 50 Palestinians have died over the past 6 days. On Saturday, an Israeli sniper shot dead a 12-year-old girl. On Friday, Israeli troops killed two volunteer paramedics with the Palestinian Ambulance Service. They were both 17 years old. The International Red Cross said it was appalled by Israel's failure to protect personnel engaged in emergency medical duties. Israel's vowed to continue its offensive that it claims is needed to stop Palestinian rocket attacks in Israeli towns. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh accused Israel of committing genocide.
These massacres are committed from the highest command of the Israeli government. For that, we call upon the Arab and Islamic world and the international community to stand by their responsibilities and conscience, and to stand in front of the killing of the people, the women and the children, the destruction and the aggression. What is happening is a programmed genocide for the Palestinian people.
The Finnish presidency of the European Union warned against the disproportionate use of violence. Pope Benedict the 16th appealed for a halt to the bloodshed.
Seguo con viva preoccupazione le notizie.
It is with deep worry that I am following the news about the grave deterioration of the situation in Gaza. And I want to express my closeness to the civilian populations who are suffering the consequences of acts of violence.
In Nicaragua, early results from Sunday's presidential election show Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega might have won enough support to avoid a runoff. With returns in almost 15% of polling stations, Ortega had just above the 40% mark that would seal a first-round win. His chief rival, the conservative Eduardo Montealegre, has refused to concede defeat. As many as 25,000 people rallied in London Saturday to mark the International Day of Climate Action. The march began with a rally at the U.S. Embassy. Protesters carried banners reading, quote, George Bush wanted for crimes against the planet. Meanwhile, in Kenya, over 6,000 delegates have gathered for a new round of U.N. talks on climate change. On Sunday, the United Nations warned global warming could devastate the continent of Africa. The report found 70 million people could face risks of coastal flooding within 75 years linked to rising seas. More than a quarter of African wildlife habitats also risk destruction. Kenya's environment minister, Kivutha Kibwana, told delegates, quote, climate change is rapidly emerging as one of the most serious threats that humanity may ever face. In other environmental news, a new study in Science magazine is warning the world could be without edible fish in just over 40 years. The study found fish stocks have collapsed in nearly one-third of sea fisheries, and the rate of decline is accelerating. The editors of the nation's four main military newspapers have called for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign. The editorial appears today in the Army Times, Navy Times, Air Force Times, and Marine Corps Times. The editorial states, quote, it's one thing for the majority of Americans to think Rumsfeld has failed. But when the nation's current military leaders start to break publicly with their defense secretary, then it's clear he's losing control of the institution he ostensibly leads. The editorial goes on to say, quote, Rumsfeld has lost credibility with the uniformed leadership, with the troops, with Congress, and with the public at large. His strategy has failed. The Army Times and the other papers are civilian-owned but distributed to troops across the globe. Meanwhile, Vanity Fair is reporting a number of prominent neoconservatives who advocated for the invasion of Iraq are now criticizing President Bush's handling of the war. The list includes former Pentagon advisors Richard Perle and Kenneth Edelman, former presidential speechwriter David Frum, and Michael Rubin, a former senior official in the Pentagon's Office of Special Plans. Richard Perle admitted huge mistakes were made in Iraq. Perle criticized Vanity Fair because he claimed he'd been promised that his remarks would not be published until after the midterm election. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration has told a federal judge that prisoners once held in secret CIA jail should never be allowed to reveal to their civilian attorneys details of how they were interrogated. The government says in new court filings that those interrogation methods are among the nation's most sensitive national security secrets and that their release could cause extremely grave damage. Gitanjali Gutierrez, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, said the government's trying to conceal illegal or embarrassing executive conduct. Northwestern University law professor Joseph Margulies said this means prisoners would be barred from even saying what the government did to them to elicit the statements that are the basis for them being held. Margulies said, quote, Kafkaesque doesn't do it justice. This is Alice in Wonderland. In Afghanistan, Italian photojournalist Gabriele Torcello has been released 3 weeks after he was kidnapped.
Very glad that I'm here tonight, and I'm very thankful to everybody, to the Italian government, to the government of Afghanistan, to everybody, every single individual who has thought about me and has collaborated in an active way and also in a moral way in my release. And it has been quite intense, about 22 days.
On Sunday, Gabriele Torcello was reunited with his family in Italy. And the Christian evangelical leader Ted Haggard admitted Sunday to being a deceiver and liar who'd committed sexually immoral conduct. Up until last week, Haggard was the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. But the minister was forced to resign after a male prostitute in Denver revealed that Haggard had regularly visited his apartment for the past 3 years for sex and drugs. Haggard at first denied the allegations. He wrote a letter to his congregation admitting he had sinned. His letter was read by the Reverend Larry Stockstill from the pulpit on Sunday.
The fact is, I am guilty of sexual immorality, and I take responsibility for the entire problem. I am a deceiver and a liar. There is a part of my life that is so repulsive and dark that I've been warring against it all of my adult life.
Reverend Larry Stockstill reading a letter from Haggard from the pulpit on Sunday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, millions of voters will cast their vote in the midterm elections. Many are calling this the most high-stakes election in recent years, with the possibility of a Democratic takeover of Congress. But some are warning voters could be subject to intimidation, a variety of suppressive tactics meant to keep them from casting a ballot. Some of these tactics have been mandated by the government, like new rules requiring government-issued voter identification cards. Others have been perpetrated by unofficial sources, such as the bogus letter sent to thousands of Latino voters in California telling them it's illegal to vote. Adam Cohen is an editorial writer with the New York Times. His piece in today's paper is called Protecting the Right to Vote. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, Adam, you've been following the whole issue of voting for quite a long time now. What are the issues, the key issues you see right now?
Well, the first issue is electronic voting. About 80% of Americans will be voting on electronic voting machines on Tuesday, and we don't really have a lot of confidence that those votes will necessarily be accurately recorded. We've already seen some problems in the early voting. In Montgomery County, Maryland, in the primary, there was absolute chaos when they failed to include the a necessary part for the electronic voting machines. So people were literally casting ballots that they wrote on scraps of paper. Poll workers were reading the candidates' names, and voters were just writing names literally on pieces of paper. The machines weren't working.
So the machines, they had to put them aside.
They weren't working. They were missing a key part. So there was actually, the word chaos was used. That's Montgomery County, Maryland. In Virginia, we already know that on the summary sheet in some Virginia electronic voting machines, Jim Webb, the Democratic candidate for Senate, his full name will not appear. It cuts off after his middle name. So Webb does not appear on the summary page.
What do you mean by summary page?
Well, when you vote on an electronic voting machine, often you make your choices by hitting various buttons, and then at the end, you get a summary of all the choices you've made, and you confirm that that's correct. So that should, that summary page should have all the candidates you chose.
It's not actually a piece of paper. It's the screen.
It's the screen, but for some reason, the electronic voting machine manufacturer that made a lot of machines in Virginia was unable to fit Jim Webb's entire name on there. They admit that it was a mistake. They say they'll do better next year, but people are actually going to be voting with this flawed technology that has the full Republican name and only half of the Democrat's name.
Isn't there a law against this?
Well, everyone says we're going to try better next year, but that those are not even the worst problems. I would say the worst problem we've seen so far in early voting is in Broward County, Florida, where people are reporting that when they've chosen the Democratic candidate for governor, they've made that choice. When they get to the summary page and need to confirm that their choices were, you know, correctly recorded, they see that they've actually voted for the Republican. The name has flipped. And that's something that people have brought to the attention of the election officials, and they say that they have a way of rejiggering the machine. They actually admit that when the machines are heavily used, they get out of sync, and sometimes they do flip the vote from, in this case, Democrats to Republican.
But explain how this is happening. This goes to the issue of early voting.
Yeah. Well, people are voting now in many states. More than 20% of all votes have already been cast around the country. They're voting on electronic voting machines. And you would think that an electronic voting machine would have to absolutely accurately reflect the choices voter made before it could be used in an election. That's not true. It's a very, very imprecise science. These electronic voting machine companies are really not very good at making these machines.
But in the case of Broward County, if you cast your vote for the Democratic governor and it shows up as a Republican governor on the computer screen, what do? You then have to walk out to one of the poll workers and say, can you come in and look at my computer? And then they also see what your choice is.
Yeah. And you say, you know, I chose the Democrat, but actually on the summary page, it's showing me that I'm voting for the Republican. Could you please do something about that? And then they will recalibrate the machine. They may take the machine out of service. I actually talked with someone from the Broward County elections office last week, and I said, I hear you're having some problems with electronic voting down there. And she said, no, there are no problems, because if the voters tell us that there's a mistake on the summary page, we can fix it. Now, to my mind, that's a problem if the voter needs to catch that. Otherwise, their Democratic vote will become a Republican vote. But apparently, they don't consider that a problem.
But isn't there, aren't there issues about privacy in voting?
There are issues about, I mean,
aren't there issues of,
you should absolutely not have to bring an elections official to say, I've chosen a Democrat and it's coming up as a Republican, because you're telling them your vote. You also shouldn't have to be voting on a scrap of paper in Montgomery County. You know, in San Diego, actually, we just learned that they ran out of absentee ballots. So the official ballots that they mailed to some people in San Diego are Xeroxes, which you vote on this Xerox, and then when you send it in, election workers will transfer your choice onto a proper ballot, which will then be scanned properly. That's crazy, but they've just run out of proper ballots.
Now, in Maryland, the governor said they will not use electronic voting machines tomorrow. Is that right?
No, they are using them. He's discouraging people from using them, and you have the choice not to. But they were one of the states that went earliest to all Diebold voting machines. They, in Georgia, they hopped on the bandwagon very early, and now there's a lot of buyer's remorse because people realize that these Diebold voting machines, which do not have paper trails, are not reliable. Even if they have all the parts on election day, you're not sure that they're working properly.
In the case of Virginia, can Webb simply challenge the vote? Because his name will not appear.
I think the theory is that at least his name is fully represented on the first page where you make the choice, and that maybe it's not so important that it be correct on the summary ballot. Although, since we know that sometimes the votes are flipping in Broward, you'd like to be sure that your full name is there on the summary so that people can catch it. You know, these are the imperfections that, you know, someone could try to challenge. I don't know if a judge would set aside an election because of it.
What about what's coming out of Memphis, the early memory cards being lost? There was some rumor of this?
Yeah. The Drudge Report online made a big deal last week about some voter cards going missing. And I think that we still don't know exactly what is going on there and who took them or whether how many votes can be voted with these, I believe, 12 cards that are missing.
What do you mean by cards?
These are cards that a voter uses to actually, you have a card when you go to vote that you put into the machine, and some of these are missing. It doesn't appear to be a large number. It doesn't seem like it's a number that would really change the election, but it's definitely feeding into people's anxieties.
And you're saying 20% of the votes will be cast by tomorrow already, people who are in states where there is early voting.
At least that many have already been cast, yes.
What about the issue of voter suppression?
Well, it's an issue every year, and we saw it this year with 14,000 letters that were sent out in Southern California in Loretta Sanchez's district to voters with Latino names saying that if you're an immigrant, you're not allowed to vote, which is absolutely untrue, of course. If you're an immigrant and you're naturalized and you're registered to vote, you can vote. But that was false information that was systematically sent out. But we're seeing it in many other places in many other ways. Some small ways, there were reports of radio commercials in black neighborhoods in Baltimore earlier this year saying that Martin Luther King was a Republican. Not true, but designed to suppress the black vote, which is going to be very important in Maryland this year. And then we're seeing government forms of suppression with voter ID laws that are designed not just to ensure that only people who are registered to vote can vote, but actually to stop a lot of people from voting.
We'll talk about the issue of voter ID laws after break. We're talking to Adam Cohen, editorial writer for The New York Times, tracking the votes. Stay with us.
So cast your vote. Election day is coming. Cast your vote, yeah. Right here in America. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, no. Don't be afraid, no. Nobody's talking about de-escalation. Nobody's talking about de-escalation. No, no, so cast your vote. Cause election day is coming.
Election Day by miles away here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, on NPR stations, on low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations, PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish, in transcript and in audio form for radio stations to take as they are throughout Latin America, the United States, and in Europe. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the issue of voter suppression, voter confusion, of problems in early voting, of who will be counted, and the hidden history of voter disenfranchisement in this country, our guest is Adam Cohen. He is editorial writer for The New York Times, talking about the issue of whose votes get counted. Before we move on San Diego, the letter, was it ever traced who put out this letter telling Latinos they can't vote?
Well, there was an investigation, and it's believed to have been done by the Republican candidate running against Loretta Sanchez, the congresswoman in that area. And there's some question about how directly involved he was.
And Baltimore, the ad saying that Dr. Martin Luther King was a Republican?
I'm not sure where those have come from, but, you know, often on Election Day, you see all kinds of flyers and things that come out that never get traced to anyone, saying the election has been postponed, various other things like that. People just, you know, they never find out who did that kind of stuff.
Voter identification.
Yeah. Actually, even before voter ID, there's this issue of voter registration, where what we've been seeing now is states cracking down on perfectly legitimate voter registration drives. And we saw this in 2004 when, you may recall, Kenneth Blackwell, who's the Secretary of State of Ohio, began rejecting perfectly valid voter registration forms. At one point, he came up with a rule that said if it wasn't on thick enough paper, 80-pound thick paper, it would be rejected, which was, you know, a crazy rule that under pressure, he withdrew. We're not seeing that this year, but we did see Florida adopted very, very strict rules for voter registration drives, so strict that the League of Women Voters of Florida, for the first time in, I think, 70 years, stopped registering people to vote because they were afraid of the criminal and civil penalties associated with that. So we're seeing that.
Explain criminal penalties.
Well, Florida's legislature, which is not so receptive to voter registration drives, came up with rules that said if there was a certain number of inaccuracies, if you didn't hand in the forms on time, lots of technical requirements. But, you know, when you do a registration drive, you do the best you can. But the League of Women Voters didn't want to do a drive if it meant if they didn't get the form that they collected from a prospective voter into an elections office within X number of days, they would be fined. I don't know that there were criminal penalties, but the civil penalties that they calculated could easily eat up their entire budget for the organization. So they stopped registering people.
Voter ID.
We've seen a number of attempts around the country to try to stop people from voting through overly onerous voter ID rules. Now, everyone agrees that there can be some reasonable request that you present ID when you vote, but what we've seen is incredibly strict rules. So Georgia started this out with a rule that you had to actually, if you didn't have a driver's license, you had to buy a voter ID card. So that meant that poor people in Georgia, were essentially subject to a poll tax. The court struck that down, but it was very clear that Georgia was trying to stop people from voting, including the fact that when that law went into effect, there was no office in the entire city of Atlanta where you could buy that card. And they had a bus that they had traveling around the state, and if you were able to find that bus, you could buy your card there. But the Atlanta Journal-Constitution actually followed the bus and found that it kept breaking down. It was like a 15-year-old bus, and I think it ended up issuing like 500 cards in a month, and there were 300,000 people who needed the card. So that has been struck down, Georgia's rule. But there are other states like Indiana and Arizona that have very strict voter ID laws that are in effect for this election. And as Bob Herbert, my colleague, writes in his column today, Julia Carson, a congresswoman from Indiana, tried to vote with her congressional ID, and that was initially deemed not to be acceptable ID. So you can imagine they're really trying to discourage.
In Indiana,
discourage people.
She showed her congressional ID.
And the initial ruling was that it was not acceptable because it didn't have an expiration date on it. I think that was eventually appealed, but you get the idea. If they're not letting a famous congresswoman in Indiana vote with her congressional ID, they're not really trying to make every vote count.
What about the issue of voter roll purges?
Yes. This is something we remember from 2000 when Catherine Harris did that very bad felon voter purge that ended up disenfranchising many people who weren't felons at all. This goes on all the time because we don't really have a lot of access to how Board of Elections keep their voter rolls. So they can purge names without a lot of notice. And we've seen already once this year in Kentucky, they announced a purge that was improper, it had a high error rate, and a court actually ordered them not to do that purge. Here in New York State, we have a state senator who's running in an incredibly close race. He won his seat 2 years ago by a very small margin. Last week, Republicans in his district presented the names of 5,000 people they said were on the rolls improperly. Well, if you do that a few days before the election, it's hard to know what the Board of Elections can do, but there's a lot of concern in that district that these people may be eligible to vote, but maybe stop from voting.
On the issue of purges, it's something we know well from Florida from 2000. Let's talk a little about the issue, the history of voter disenfranchisement. Just can you go back in time, put 2006 in context? You can go back to the beginning of people voting in the United States.
Sure. People sort of think that 2000 was the beginning of problems with voting because that was when we saw it in Bush versus Gore. But in fact, if you look back at the history of voting in the United States, there's always been an attempt to use rules of various kinds to stop certain people from voting. It's always been a partisan thing. One party realizes if it stops a particular ethnic group or racial group from voting, it may win, and they adopt rules that appear to be neutral but actually aren't neutral at all. So, for example, in New York State, the first voter registration laws were passed in 1840. They applied only to New York City, and everyone understood that it was Republicans in the state who were trying to disenfranchise Irish Catholics in New York City. through these voter registration rules. In 1921, there was a constitutional amendment that was passed in New York State adopting a literacy test for the first time. Everyone knows that was done to stop Yiddish-speaking voters in New York City from being able to vote. And around the country, we've seen many other rules of this kind. New Jersey, for a while, they adopted what were called sunset laws, which required the polls to close at sunset. And everyone knows the reason was that workers were still working in the factories. And the plan was that by the time they were off of their shifts, the polls would be closed.
And you take that through to now, I mean, immigrants and also, and you've written about this with Abraham Lincoln talking about the issue.
Absolutely. They tried to, in Massachusetts, for example, Republicans tried to extend the period of time after an immigrant was naturalized that they had to wait in order to vote. And Abraham Lincoln, who was a Republican, and it was his own party that was promoting that rule, said, this really isn't right. You know, America is about letting people vote. And he actually did not support that rule. But we've seen in many other places, of course, you know, we don't even need to talk about all the rules in the South through Jim Crow and after that were designed to stop blacks from voting, particularly in places where blacks were in the majority.
And we should comment that Julia Carson of Indianapolis, first woman and first African-American to be elected by Indianapolis to Congress.
Right. And apparently her congressional ID was not sufficient proof of her eligibility to vote.
And so today, or I should say tomorrow, what are you looking for as the most serious violations that we might see tomorrow?
Well, we're going to see a lot of things. First of all, we'll see who's actually allowed to vote. We'll see if there are improper challenges at the polls. The Washington Post reported that in Maryland, where there's going to be some very close races, that the Republicans have issued guides for their poll workers that advise them to threaten the election judges with arrest if they don't stop various people from voting. So it could get very intense. So we'll see that. We may see fights over who gets to vote. We'll see voter ID laws perhaps wrongly applied. We're also seeing dirty tricks. We're seeing this already with the blogosphere is speaking a lot right now about apparently there's a Republican robocall dirty trick campaign going on nationwide that's designed to suppress the Democratic vote. And what the blogosphere says, I don't know this firsthand, but is that in about 50 races around the country, Republicans are doing robocalls that appear to be from Democrats that are coming early in the morning, late at night. They call back 7 or 8 times, and it's designed to make voters think that the Democratic candidate is harassing them. And in some cases, voters are calling up the Democratic campaign headquarters and saying, I'm not voting for you. You keep on calling me. But in fact, supposedly, it's actually a Republican robocall. So we're hearing about
robocall. You mean
this is a non-human voice? It's an electronic, you know, it's an automated phone call, and they can make hundreds of thousands of these very cheaply because it's just a machine calling. But as I say, it's designed apparently to be done in a deceptive way.
Does it explain at any point who is responsible for the call?
Well, the scripts I've seen online, they start by saying, here's some important information about the Democrat running for office, and it goes on for a while. People generally hang up and are angry at the Democrat. If you stay on the line long enough, eventually it says, but actually, you know, this is the Republican Party calling, and we're warning you about this bad Democrat. But either people hang up at the beginning and they think a Democrat is harassing them, or if they listen to the end, they get the Republican message. But mainly people are hanging up and reportedly being called again and again and again right afterwards, which no one would design their own robocalls to do that. That's designed to apparently leave a bad taste in voters' mouths.
There's a piece in the New York Times today, a new telemarketing ploy steers voters on Republican path, meaning this piece.
Yeah, although that's focusing more on the sort of intelligent use of robocalls to these are calls that they say, do you care about abortion? Are you opposed to abortion? And if you hit yes, it will then take you to a message about why the Republican is the right person to vote for. So that's sort of the more benign kind of robocall, although still very sophisticated. And some people are calling it a form of push polling because they do say negative things about the opponent. But that's at least within the realm still, I would say, of not being a dirty trick. This other one of pretending to be from the other side and harassing people is worse.
We're talking to Adam Cohen, editorial writer for The New York Times. The very close races that could determine the balance of the Senate, where they stand today, for example, Tennessee.
Yes. I think people right now are saying that control of the Senate probably rests on Missouri, Tennessee, and Virginia. Tennessee, incredibly close. Harold Ford, the first African-American who has a real shot in modern times of representing the state. We've seen a very spirited campaign, allegations that the Republicans have been using racially charged advertising against him. I don't think anyone knows how that is going to turn out. I mean, there have been polls both ways showing Ford up a little. Lately, Corker seems to have closed the gap or the Republican or moved ahead. But I think it's all going to come down to turnout in Tennessee.
And Virginia?
Virginia, there too, a fascinating, very high-profile race. We all know about Senator Allen and his problems. Jim Webb is the Democrat. They've been seesawing back and forth. Some polls say that Webb is up by 1 or 2 points. Again, turnout will be very important. Virginia is a state that has been Republican for a long time, but they've elected two Democratic governors lately. And Democrats in the state, I think, are cautiously optimistic that Webb may win that one.
And in Missouri?
Missouri may well be the closest race in the country. Seems to be dead even, 47-47, 49-49, depending on the poll, between Jim Talent, the Republican incumbent, Claire McCaskill. Missouri has some of the closest races in the country. I think people feel that could come down to literally just a few thousand votes in the end.
Arizona seems to be in play in a way that no one talked about before.
Yeah, no one was really focusing on Arizona, but in the last few days, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has been pumping more money into it because Kyle, the Republican incumbent, does seem to be vulnerable. He's really not been above 50% in the polls for a while, and that's a vulnerable place for an incumbent to be. Peterson, the Democrat, has a lot of money on his own, and I think there, too, people just think it will come down to who actually turns out to vote on Tuesday.
And then you've got the House. You had the New York Times headline yesterday, GOP glum as it struggles to hold Congress, some of the closest races there.
Yeah, I think people are looking particularly to the Northeast there. Connecticut has three very closely contested races where some of the moderate Republicans are in trouble, people like Chris Shays, Nancy Johnson, and the Philadelphia suburbs, three more close races where, again, moderate Republicans are in danger. Upstate New York has some other races where Republican seats could go Democratic. Those states alone could make up most of the seats that the Democrats would need to make up the 15 seats they need to take the majority.
And the language that's being used now, because, of course, in every one of these local races where the Democratic Party, where the Republican Party pours resources in, they're going larger than that particular race. I mean, for example, Nancy Johnson, big pharmaceutical support, insurance support. But when they pour money into the race, they're talking to the electorate about what the complexion of the country will look like, what the composition of Congress will be.
Right. We're really seeing a battle here where the Democrats are trying to nationalize these races. The Republicans are trying to keep them local. So you see the Democrats saying Nancy Johnson is one more vote for the Republican majority. President Bush really wants Nancy Johnson reelected. Nancy Johnson talks about things like, look at all the bacon I've brought home for the district. Here's a parkland that I turned into a federal park. You know, local, local, local. And you're seeing that repeated again and again and again, where the Republicans want to say, you know, this isn't a referendum on Iraq or on President Bush. This is about all the things I've done for, you know, the community.
In New Mexico, a very close race with the incumbent Heather Wilson.
Yes. Heather Wilson appears to be in trouble. Patricia Madrid, the attorney general, has been running very strong. And that's part of this trend in the West. A lot of states that had been Republican are now trending Democratic. We're seeing that in New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado is another state like that, where, you know, they're purple states now, but they seem to be moving in a blue direction.
Any other major issues, major races that you're right now looking at?
Well, there are a couple of races that the Republicans hope they'll be able to take a few Senate seats away from the Democrats, which would really block their chance of taking over. So they talk about New Jersey. They talk about maybe knocking off Menendez. I don't think that's realistic. New Jersey is a very blue state. Menendez seems to have pulled ahead. Maryland, the Republicans are looking to possibly win that with Michael Steele against Ben Cardin, but I think Cardin will win that as well. Rhode Island should be interesting. It looked for sure that Chafee was going to lose, the Republican incumbent, a week or two ago. Now the polls have tightened, but I still think the Democrat there is likely to unseat him.
Very unusual case also because Chafee is not exactly in the past embraced by the Republican Party.
No, he went out of his way to say that he personally didn't vote for President Bush, and what may be helping him close the gap is he's done a commercial where he says, hey, you know, I voted against this war. He's almost trying to sound like a Democrat, and that may be helping him in the end.
And there's also an interesting ballot initiative in Rhode Island around the issue of felon disenfranchisement.
Yes. Rhode Islanders have a chance to vote for a constitutional amendment that would make it, that would extend the vote to some felons right now, people who are on parole and probation who need to wait right now in Rhode Island till those end. So people can be out of jail in Rhode Island and for 10, 20, 30 years still not be able to vote. And I think that would be a good thing
if
that
passed. How typical is that?
These laws vary by state, but usually that's not uncommon. I think 37 or more states have rules like that. What is uncommon is having a referendum and having the voters have their say. And there's a decent chance that will pass.
Adam Cohen, thank you very much for being with us. Adam Cohen is editorial writer for The New York Times. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, an Iraqi special tribunal convicted Saddam Hussein of crimes against humanity and sentenced him to death by hanging. The deposed Iraqi ruler was convicted of the killing of 148 Shia villagers in the town of Jijail in 1982. Seven co-defendants were also convicted, two of them, Barzani Ibrahim al-Tikriti, Saddam's half-brother and head of Iraq's domestic intelligence agency, and Awad al-Bandar, president of the Revolutionary Court, also received death sentences. Celebrations in Shia strongholds broke out across Iraq after the verdict was issued. This is a resident of Jijail speaking Sunday about the verdict.
We are happy for the families of the victims and mothers who have children and sons who have been killed. This is the least that Saddam deserved. He should have been hanged 10 times and not only once.
Saddam's supporters also marched in support of the ousted leader in the Sunni strongholds of Samarra, Hawija, Kirkuk, and Tikrit. The verdict came nearly 3 years after Saddam Hussein was captured in his underground hideaway by U.S. troops. His trial began more than a year ago and was marked by delays, violence, outbursts from Saddam Hussein condemning the proceedings. During the course of the trial, 3 defense lawyers were killed, and the original chief judge resigned in protest over government interference. When the verdict was read Sunday, Saddam shouted, "You don't decide. You are servants of the occupiers and their followers. You are puppets." Many international legal and human rights experts have questioned the legitimacy of the court. Human Rights Watch issued a statement saying, quote, "Unfortunately, we believe the serious shortcomings in the fairness of the proceedings undermine the legitimacy and credibility of the trial." But President Bush hailed the verdict as a milestone.
Today, Saddam Hussein was convicted and sentenced to death by the Iraqi High Tribunal for the massacres committed by his regime in the town of Jijail. Saddam Hussein's trial is a milestone in the Iraqi people's efforts to replace the rule of a tyrant with the rule of law. It's a major achievement for Iraq's young democracy and its constitutional government. During Saddam Hussein's trial, the court received evidence from 130 witnesses. The man who once struck fear in the hearts of Iraqis had to listen to free Iraqis recount the acts of torture and murder that he ordered against their families and against them. Today, the victims of this regime have received a measure of the justice which many thought would never come. Saddam Hussein will have an automatic right to appeal his sentence. He will continue to receive the due process and legal rights that he denied to the Iraqi people. Iraq has a lot of work ahead as it builds its society that delivers equal justice and protects all its citizens. Yet history will record today's judgment as an important achievement on the path to a free and just and unified society.
President Bush on Sunday. Scott Horton joins us now, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York Bar Association, also member of the Iraqi Bar Association. Welcome to Democracy.
Good to be with you.
Your response to the verdict.
Well, I think the evidence against Saddam Hussein is clear and impressive. And in fact, I think we have to salute Human Rights Watch, which did a tremendous job over many years of documenting the violations, including the Dujail incident. So I think people are relieved to see that sentence. But when we come to the fairness and legitimacy of the proceedings, there are very, very deep concerns. And I think it's all wrapped around the timing of the announcement of the verdict, which was very carefully planned to be the last print media day, so we would have headlines above the fold in American newspapers on the day before Americans go to vote in very, very important midterm elections.
Who decides this?
Well, I think the Americans decided that. And in fact, I can tell you from my own experiences dealing with Iraqi courts, the calendar of the court was fixed directly by the Americans. One Iraqi judge I discussed this with told me that, look, we are autonomous and independent in many regards, and the calendar is not one of them. The calendar is fixed by when the Americans want us to convene the court and when they produce the witnesses so that we can interrogate them and conduct hearings. And this is particularly true for the so-called special tribunal. We need to note that this was constructed, arranged from the beginning with American taxpayer money, $138 million put into funding it, a large professional staff, the regime crime unit attached to the U.S. Embassy, orchestrating every aspect of this case, compiling claims, putting them together, even making the physical plan and layout for the courtroom.
Where else was the U.S. involved in the shaping of this trial?
Well, I think the decision to bring the charges that were brought, focusing on the Dujail incident first, putting off to later the far more troubling genocide aspects, so that was another area where there was clearly American sleight of hand involved.
President Bush makes the point of saying that Saddam Hussein can appeal this. What does that mean?
Well, that's correct. There is an automatic appeal that kicks in. This is the first time, of course, for this entire proceeding. We don't know exactly the amount of time that will be involved. I think most people have looked at it, considered that this is going to be a matter of a couple of months, perhaps 3 months at the outside. And then the execution sentence itself has to be confirmed by the government. But I'd also say no one in Iraq is surprised by the decision. Most people consider that it was foreordained from the beginning.
You've called this the November surprise of President Bush?
That's correct. I mean, I think the it was vitally important to the United States and to Iraq for this proceeding to be legitimate, to be seen by the Iraqi people as legitimate. It was necessary as a sort of exorcism of the ghost of Saddam Hussein and his past tyranny. And I think the brazen political manipulation of this trial by the Bush administration has dramatically undercut that. And this is something that's fully understood by everyone in Iraq. In fact, if you go and you look at River Bend, the very prominent Iraqi blogger, she's writing about it this morning.
Scott Horton, I wanted to go back to another story, one that we have covered that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, Mohammed Manaf. He is the Iraqi-American who has just been sentenced to death also. Can you talk about his case?
Well, I was astounded by that when I first heard a report about it. And I picked up the phone and I spoke with the two Iraqi attorneys were involved representing him in that case. The Brennan Center here in New York was also involved. So I spoke with the defense counsel. I also spoke with a bailiff at the court about it to find out what had happened in this proceeding. And what they all described, in fact, completely, they all had exactly the same account of what happened, was shocking. They say that he was brought into the courtroom, Mr. Manaf, by two American officers. One they described as, quote, the general. The other they described as a man named Lieutenant Perrone. He was brought before the court. The court had announced at a prior session that, reviewing the evidence of the case, he had concluded that he would dismiss the charges, that there were no substantial charges, and that at this hearing that would be a conclusion to the affair. There would be a dismissal.
And this was the case of an Iraqi-American who had accompanied three Romanian journalists?
Who were kidnapped.
Who were all kidnapped, including him.
That's correct. And then the account is that this American lieutenant stood up, began arguing very loudly with the judge, saying it was unacceptable that this man be dismissed, that he had to be convicted, and moreover, that he had to receive the death sentence. And the American whipped out a piece of paper saying he was there speaking on behalf of the government of Romania, and the government of Romania demanded the death sentence. Afterwards, there was a private discussion, I'm told, between the Americans and the judge. The judge emerged from this ashen face, looking very upset, and then proceeded immediately to convict the man and sentence him to death. And subsequently, the government of Romania reacted, saying they knew nothing about this proceeding, and they certainly did not authorize an American officer to stand up in the court and demand the death sentence. In fact, the government of Romania does not endorse the death sentence. So there's something very strange going on about this case. An application was made to the district court in Washington, D.C., to get a freezing order, an injunction against this American, who is being held by the United States, by the way, in Iraq, but being held by U.S. forces in Iraq, to preclude his being turned over to the Iraqi authorities. That was denied by the district court, was denied by the Court of Appeals on the basis, remember, of the Military Commissions Act, which essentially has gutted the writ of habeas corpus. So we have an American citizen who may be, in fact, executed in Iraq at the insistence of the American military, without any ability of the U.S. courts to intervene and provide justice in the case, without a trial. I have to stress that.
Why do you think the U.S. military wants Manaf dead?
I have no idea.
You have represented others. You're a member of the Iraqi Bar Association.
Yes, I'm a foreign international law expert accredited to the Iraqi Bar Association.
There is also an AP reporter who is being held in jail, Bilal Hussein, the Associated Press reporter. What is his story now?
He is now in his seventh month of detention.
He's a photographer.
He won the Pulitzer Prize, in fact, 2 years ago for his work covering the siege and military operations in Fallujah. He is a photojournalist. He's in his seventh month. No charges have been brought against him. The U.S. forces hold him, and they say that they are under no obligation to bring any charges against him of any kind, and they assert that they have the right to hold him indefinitely without charges. This is something out of Kafka.
The presidents of the Associated Press Managing Editors, APME, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, ASNI, the Associated Press Photo Managers have sent a joint letter to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld asking for the release of Bilal Hussein, saying the members of our three organizations stand united in our outrage at the imprisonment of our colleague. On what grounds are they holding him? And is this similar to another case that you have represented in Iraq?
Absolutely, it is. The grounds articulated are that he presents an imperative threat to the security of U.S. forces in Iraq. And the imperative threat he presents is the fact that he takes pictures of events in Iraq for the Associated Press. And the gravamen of the complaints they've raised are about Associated Press distributed photographs that he has taken.
What was the case that you represented similar to this, where they were going after a reporter, ultimately killed a reporter?
He was shot, a reporter,
who simply shows up at the scene. It's very hard for U.S. journalists to do this. It mainly falls to Iraqi journalists.
That's exactly right. It was Abdul Amir Yunus Hussein, who was a CBS photojournalist, who was dispatched to cover an incident in Mosul, was shot in the aftermath of the incident by a U.S. Sharpshooter, was held by U.S. forces for 1 year. Finally, just in the last few days of that period, the U.S. brought charges against him. It went before an Iraqi judge, an Iraqi trial. I participated in his defense in the trial. The trial resulted in a complete acquittal. In fact, with the trial judge saying, this is not a case in which we had to weigh the evidence. There was no evidence against this man. So his incarceration was completely improper. He was at the scene of that incident on the instructions of his employer, based on a tip, CBS, based on the tip received from two other wire agencies about what was going on there. And all that was confirmed and demonstrated to the military. It didn't make any difference.
Wasn't he also, it just so happens in that case, it was a Stryker vehicle and Congress was weighing whether to fund the company?
That very week, in fact. His shooting and the seizure of his materials prevented film footage of that Stryker, which was destroyed, being disseminated on CBS News. It would have been on the evening news that night.
And the point was they said it was invulnerable, but that it had blown up.
Absolutely correct.
We're talking to Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York Bar Association. I wanted to ask you about this latest headline in The Washington Post, reporting the Bush administration has told a federal judge that prisoners once held in secret CIA jails should never be able to reveal to their civilian attorneys details of how they were interrogated.
Well, I think one of the hallmarks of tyrannical government is using security classifications to obscure their criminal conduct. It's well worth thinking about that in the context of this case. What's going on is an effort to impede the effective legal representation of defendants in criminal proceedings through the wielding of security classifications. These people are told that what we did to you is classified top secret. Therefore, you may not talk about it. Of course, what was done to them was a criminal act. The Supreme Court of the United States concluded in Hamden that Common Article 3 and the standards on treatment of detainees apply to these detainees. The techniques that were used do not conform to Common Article 3. Therefore, they are grave breaches. Therefore, they are crimes under United States law and under international law. So that is what an effort is being made to cloak that. And when the Department of Justice of the United States files papers with a federal court attempting to obscure criminal conduct, something has sunk very low in this process.
Finally, going back to the verdict for Saddam Hussein's death, the five-judge court found Saddam Hussein guilty of executing 148 Shia men and boys from the town of Dujail in 1982. It was a year later that Donald Rumsfeld, as an envoy for Reagan and Bush administration, went to Iraq, shook hands with Saddam Hussein to normalize relations.
That's correct. And Donald Rumsfeld is reported to have assured him, don't worry about all the talk coming from the United States about your human rights violations. We're going to support you, and we're going to offer you backup in your conflict with Iran.
Scott Horton, I want to thank you for being with us. Thank you, Chair of the International Law Committee at the New York Bar Association, member of the Iraqi Bar Association. And our transcript will be online at democracynow.org. You can also sign up there for our daily digest for our headlines at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Thanks also to Hugh Grand, Peter Yoon, Tyshawn Black, Jerome Bourgeois, Megan Whitney, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Angela Alston, Uri Galette. You can go to our website for our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. We'll be traveling to San Francisco, also Washington, D.C. in the coming days. That's at democracynow.org. You can also tell your friends about Democracy Now! And let them know that any radio station, TV station, public access, or PBS, or NPR, or low-power FM, college or community radio station, can pick up Democracy Now!, now being carried on more than 500 stations around the country. And a shout out to the folks at the Old Labor Hall in Barre, Vermont, for the event yesterday and all the stations that helped bring out that Breaking the Sound Barrier event. It was very interesting to be in Vermont. We'll talk about that in the coming days. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.